When I was a year and a half sober, I was sober, but I was kind of cynical. And I had a mean sponsor who'd been mean to me. But I'd stayed sober despite him. He made me take dumb actions like inventories and things. But they had the International Convention in Long Beach, California. I would never have gone to such a dumb thing with all those sheep. But it was only 20 miles away, so I went down there. I didn't have any front teeth, so I wasn't... judging right and left of these old, successful old-timers, the old fat pukes and the... And we got to this... It was held in a football stadium because it's, you know, they had a big crowd for that time, 10,000 people, this meeting. And they held in a football stadium. And it's very, not at all organized the way conventions are now. Now they're just like, you know, Nazi reunions at Nuremberg. But then they were just, people milled around and there's a whole bunch of us milling outside of this football stadium. And somebody comes and said, "Hey, wait a minute, we need a few ushers. Anybody want an usher?" And I was way in the back of this line, sort of. "Come on up here." Shut up. They brought us in, about 10 of us idiots. They gave us little blue things that said usher, and you pinned them on your sleeve. And then you, they said, "Help elderly and handicapped people find a seat." "Sure, everybody." So I hung around the gate, and one of the first ones through, some old lady, probably younger than I am now, I'm sorry to say. But I took her by the arm, and I took her right down the aisle of this enormous open place, front row, down to the stadium, because it went out in the field, the seats. I sat her down, and looked around, people were pouring in all the doors. I thought, "Jesus, why are you... I do this much longer, I'll be screwed out of a seat." So I just took off my band and sat next to her. So I had the best seat in the entire universe for the 1960 International Convention. Well, that night Bill Wilson, God, it was a great meeting. I was looking at the pictures tonight that they were flashing up here. They always give me these hideous books to point at. But I don't understand them last night or tonight, but anyway. But Bill Wilson introduced some of the famous early names, non-alcoholics. Now, it was like sitting at, you know, it's like going to the Battle of Hastings reunion and having Harold there talking. "Well, these Normans came up this way, and then I went over." It's just like living history, things I'd read in the book. And Bill finally introduced his sponsor, Ebby. And he talked for a while. He'd been sober 7 years at that time, the longest he ever stayed sober. Just a funny thing in passing about human nature. After that, about a year later, Ebby got on pills and drunk again. And he got sober and died sober, but his whole life was just a good example of it, a person who can't stay sober. And one of the things that really troubled him, I talked to a man who knew him well in Texas where he lived at the time. He said it always, his ego was always being damaged by the thought that Bill Wilson was getting all that credit and the guy that carried the message to Bill Wilson wasn't given hardly any credit. You know, it was easy to see why not. He wasn't sober, he wasn't active in AA, he wasn't doing these things. But it just shows you how the human psyche works. I'm sure we can all identify with them a little bit, as much as silly as it is. But anyway, and then he introduced Lois, and she talked, and introduced priests, and introduced Sister Ignatia talked, and it was just, and then Bill Wilson told his story, and he went on for about 2 hours, and there's a, I don't know what you're laughing at, I identify. But you know, it was cold that day. There's a funny, it gets cold sometimes in July in California because the wind comes off the ocean. And it got cold. And this meeting was going on and on and on and cold. And people were getting up with women in short dresses, very fancy dresses, but short. The trustees, and oh, God. Pretty soon people were leaving. And I was just, by this time, I was converted. And I was incensed. I looked at these people. I tried to give them the ray. And I wanted to holler, how dare you? If that old fool up there hadn't lived, you'd all be dead. And now it's a little too cool for you to listen to. Isn't that sad, for God's sakes? Folks, sit in your car and turn on the motor and put up a hose and die, kill yourself. And I sat there, and I would have, if I'd have thought I needed it, I would have said, keep going, Bill. I'll be here all night. Yeah. An old lady got up and I tripped her. Get out of here, bitch. And I came out of there with tears rolling down my cheeks, a converted man. 5 years later, now we skip. I'm now an executive in a big television station in Hollywood. I've made a good recovery. I went to Toronto. Dropped my family who had just returned to me. I dropped them off in Wisconsin to see their folks. And I went on to Toronto. I had a nice suit. Friday night, Toronto Maple Leaf Hockey Arena. Bill Wilson talked. He introduced Lois. He introduced various old-timers. Then he told his story. And he'd only been talking about 45 minutes. I found myself looking at my watch saying, God, he's just going on and on. I'm supposed to meet some folks for dinner later. Come on, Bill, end it. And I began to realize AA had changed in those last 5 years. And there's a moral to that story, but I don't know what it is. The moral is, if you are not involved, it's going to look as though AA has gone away. But it doesn't. We all do. But nothing stays wonderful after you're used to it anyway. That's why it seems to me we have to find ways to stay active in AA, even though it doesn't seem it's as exciting as it used to be. Because it isn't. Nothing is as exciting as it used to be. But we find deeper and richer meanings. But that's why I drank. I drank because I found it did stay wonderful. It made things beautiful. It made colors. There's a very touching, I don't know if any of you remember seeing the movie or Playhouse 90 thing called Days of Wine and Roses. At the end, here's this woman and she's become a drunk and her husband's now in AA and she comes to visit, pardon me. And he says, won't you please try to come to AA? And she says, you don't understand. I'm too sensitive somehow. She took him to the window and pointed down the alley. She says, look at that dirty alley down there. It's dirty water-ish. She said, but when I drink, I just see the lights reflected in the water. I don't see the dirt. She said, I can't stand ugliness. Drinking makes things different. And that's exactly as good a definition of why alcoholics drink as anything I know. It makes things different. When it's really working, it makes them beautiful. Later on, it brings them up to tolerable. But it's a funny thing, you drink, and eventually, as it must happen to people like us, if drinking works for you, and incidentally, I should say in passing, a thing to remember we sometimes forget, it doesn't do at the same time for everybody. That's why we have questions sometimes. Alcohol alters my perception of reality. And it did in me the first drink I took and from then on. Some people drink for years socially before they get that effect. That's what they mean by talking about crossing an invisible line. And you don't even know when you're crossing it. You have to see it in retrospect. But you cross an invisible line. What happens? You begin to need alcohol to keep reality bearable. And that's why we have this funny phenomenon in AA sometimes, that we have very young people now who are hearing about it, and old people. And the old people get up and they say things like, I stayed drinking for 35 years. And one day I walked through that door and I found sobriety. And they look accusingly at some little snot in the front row who's about 25. They think, as though they were saying, how can you be an alcoholic, you little snot? I drank longer than you've been alive. And what they don't realize, the little snot is sitting there thinking, you can't be much of an alcoholic if you lasted 35 years, you old son of a bitch. It turns out it isn't how long you drank, it's when it begins to do something for you. Because that's the end of your... A good argument can be made, it's been made many times, I wish I had time to talk about it, how emotional growth is really stunted when alcohol begins to work. Because at that time, you no longer have to work your way painfully through emotional conflict. I can get rid of the conflict. And it's all different. And you never again have to be with those people who painfully have to mature. Some people, even with all of that, can't mature. But people like us certainly find emotions held behind our intelligence. So eventually alcohol begins to do something to you, as we all know, as it did to me. I was sent to my first AA meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. Terrible place. I didn't stay long. I went out in the world. I became I was a writer, and I got an advertising work in public relations, and I drank, and I tried to stay drinking, and I used drinking to help me, and I tried to stay sober once in a while, but realized I wasn't really an alcoholic because my problem was not alcohol. My problem were feelings and emotions. So most of my adult life has been spent trying to drink enough to enable me to have the confidence to do what I want to do, but not so much that it got me in trouble. As has been said in chapter 3, that's the description of chapter 3. All of us have been pushed into a situation where at one time or another we've had to believe the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. Because if I don't, what the hell am I going to do? I can't stay sober and I can't be drunk. So you got to believe that. That's why it says the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. People can't, outside of us who live with us and watch us, can't understand why we do it. And they ask us, and we have no way to tell them, we don't understand either. Just leave me alone. Just leave me alone. And when you do leave me alone, I feel deserted. So there's never any end to that. Just treat me special. But you don't even know what you're saying. You're saying that, though, but you don't know it. You don't realize it. It's an endless, endless chain. But I know this. A few drinks does more to enable me to function in the world than all the psychotherapy and metaphysics I ever had. I've said this many times. 3 martinis will make you feel better than a year of psychoanalysis. They may help you find out why you feel crappy, but that's no big deal, you know. You think that'd be an answer, but you'll discover that you can find out why you feel crappy through various techniques. But there's a feeling of elation when you find out, and the elation goes away, and there you are. You feel crappy, and you know why. The only time that is ever of help to you is in a bar late at night or a pub where somebody will say, hey, what the hell's wrong with you? And you can tell them. I come from a repressed religious background and shut up. And alcohol begins to do something to you. Then you got to do something about it. Then it does something for you. And you find out stopping drinking doesn't help. So pretty soon you drink again. And people tell you your problem is alcohol, maybe your loved ones. And you just want to shout at them, you don't understand. It isn't the drinking. There's something deeper than that. You have no way to identify it, so you can't explain it. Or if you could, in retrospect, say, I feel less than somehow. I feel somehow that of myself, I'm not enough. The world will not stay wonderful. I want to be treated special. I have holes in me that the wind blows through. Now, you don't know any of these things, but you can feel them, and there's no way to explain it. But in retrospect, you and I have all had those feelings. And when I drink, it changes that. More than anything. More than philosophy. More than reading. More than religion. More than anything. And I'll try to watch it. And so we stumble through life, never knowing the nature of our illness. Knowing, I also do one thing. I'm not an alcoholic because, damn it, my problem really is an alcohol. Sometimes I drink too much. I overfill my holes. I overcompensate. It happens all the time. And people can smell the alcohol and see me drive drunk or walk drunk or fail to take care of my responsibilities. And they think my problem is alcohol. But it isn't. If it were, I'd quit. When I quit, the real alcoholics, you go to AA and you hear what happens to them. They say, I quit drinking. And the desire to quit, the desire to drink left me. I feel happy now and secure. Things are better. At home, it's wonderful. And my mind says, but that isn't you, pal. When you quit, there's a nice elation that comes. I'm going to do it all different. But in a day or two, 2 o'clock in the morning, here come my old pals. Well, I'm laying awake, looking off the darkness. Here comes my old pal anxiety back, and tension, and feelings of difference. And over a period of time, days and weeks, come resentment and the realization people are screwing me around, and the feelings of being different, and the feelings of, I don't know what it is I want, but I haven't got it. Where am I going to get it? I don't know what it is. Why aren't my children, why don't I love my children the way I should? I do, but I don't. Why? Where is the wife I should have had? Where is the job I should have had? Why? Now that's how I get sober. And so when I drink, I'm a much better father, husband, worker, everything. And the only problem is I sometimes drink too much and screw it all up. One spring, I was nominated to be Junior Chamber of Commerce Young Man of the Year in the suburb of Chicago. I was a young guy coming along. That winter, 10 months later, I was playing piano in a cheap bar in San Francisco. But I always reformed, because one thing about the Lutheran Church I always resented, I felt. It never made me good enough to stay good, but it made me good enough so I couldn't enjoy evil very long. And that's unfair, because I never had any natural tendency towards good, but I have a natural flair for evil. And I ran to a guy I'd been in the Navy with, and he was going to Texas, and a year and a half later, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. And I was writing a weekly sports column, and I was writing in a big advertising agency. And at the end of that year, I was in the state insane asylum. And I finally got out of there the next year. And the year after that, I was in Dallas writing these words for Elsie and Elmer the Cow. And 6 months after that, I was on the floor of the Phoenix Drunk Tank in Arizona, and a guy kicked my front teeth down my throat. As I was saying the other day, one of the meetings, it was one of the mornings I was glad I'd been in psychoanalysis. Because I woke up, I was in this jail in Arizona, 1,000 miles from where I'd been living, and this guy was kicking my face. He said, you vomited on my bunk, you drunken bastard. And I was so sick, I couldn't even move my head out of the way of his shoe. Well, he kicked my teeth out. But I was glad I'd been in psychoanalysis, because I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, This son of a bitch is overreacting. That gives you a feeling of superiority right there. And a month after that, I was being thrown out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles. I was an old, dying man. My life was over. I looked old and dying, and I'd been in and out of AA for 9 years by that time. I was in psychoanalysis. I'd been all over. And I was 31. Now, 31, when people come to AA 31, you hardly think they're... What used to get me when I was first going to meetings this time, people would say, I'm glad you got to AA before you had to suffer the way we did. If I had teeth, I'd bite you, you old bitch. But it turns out, whether you're on Skid Row or coming in a Cadillac, that is, what we have in common is not what you lost, your family or your job. Some flamboyant people get in more trouble than others. But that isn't what causes the problem. The problem is when the outside and the inside are so far apart, you can't take it anymore. I've been on Skid Row. Doesn't that sound sad? You know, there's only one cause that I now work on Skid Row after many years in other fields. Tell you something funny about Skid Row. Skid Row is a more emotionally comfortable place than most places. Doesn't sound like it. It's physically uncomfortable, and nobody knows they're emotionally comfortable there. I see death every day in my job. I see death from alcoholism. I now see death from crack overdose and cocaine. I see death from people exposure, hypothermia in the wintertime. I see people run over by buses. They stumble under and a bus runs over their head and smashes it. I see all kinds of death. There's only one kind of death you almost never see on Skid Row. There are never any suicides on Skid Row. Isn't that funny? You think that'd be number one cause of death. It isn't. Because there is no major conflict anymore. You've given up the outside. Do you know who commits suicide? People like who look like you and me. Who get up every morning and no matter how you feel, you got to suck it together and go out there and face them. Crap heads and pukes and lousy rotten bosses and bitches that you're married to who don't let up and unnatural children and funny situations. And then smile. Take crap from people that you'd like to just oozy down. Now that doesn't mean that everything you do is that way, but that's sometimes days are like that. People like us, we have that type of conflict when if you have nothing to do about it, you have a tendency to commit suicide. Not really, but it has to really get pretty bad. But people like us drink over those situations. People like you and me have a lot of problems. Skid Row sounds comfortable. Of course, it's not a comfortable place. But they don't know why they're there. That's why it's almost impossible to get people off Skid Row, because you can give them cars, jobs, and they can't stand the rigors of everyday life, and they go back to the streets. It's a weird thing. Some of them get off, but it's a long process. But here we all come to AA with what? What do we have in common? We all came from Skid Row? No. We all lost things? Nope. Some people don't. We all have been in jail. Some have, some haven't. Some have been in hospitals. Some haven't. What do we have in common when we come to AA? We have this in common. We have a deep-seated feeling that our case is terminally different, that they don't really understand, that stopping drinking isn't going to help, that whatever it was I wanted, I never really got. That this is not what I wanted out of life. That I don't drink because I'm a drinker. If I could only find a way to drink and not get into this trouble, I'd pay anything. These are some things people like us seem to feel. It's exciting to talk about skid rows and jails and nut houses, but they are just one aspect of flamboyant personalities. I'll tell you, when I was new, sometimes you hear people talk, and But they'd say, and now we have Betty's going to talk. And I just, she's a housewife. She's always been a housewife. And we'd sit in the back row and say, Jesus, not. Now, I've always been a housewife. I've never been in jail or hospitals. And people like me sit in the back row, oh, come on. Let's get a convict to talk. Jesus. Let's get somebody who took a shot at the Pope or something. Some excitement. As the years have gone on, I'll tell you something funny. I have come to believe that the housewife stories, as a rule, are much more horrible than mine. And I'll tell you why. Because they were chained like Prometheus to a rock. They drank for the same reason I drank. But they couldn't run. They couldn't do anything. Children to take care of, and a husband to hide from, and neighbors judging you, and having to somehow get that booze in you to survive, and never being able to run, and never being able to get away. People like me are flamboyant. I'll run. I'll do this. Ha, ha, ha. And they have to keep demure and smiling. Yes, everything is right, dear. Goodbye, honey. I would have gone crazy in 20 minutes of that, I'll tell you. You will hear, if you hear people talk, everybody comes here and they've all been on the rack and they've taken as much as they can take, they think. As they say in chapter 3, what do you get to? You lose your family? You get to your lose your home? No. You get to something much worse. You get to a point of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And you can do that in a $500 suit, and you can do that in a 10-cent Salvation Army t-shirt. And it's the same feeling exactly. I sit in my mission today, and people are come down and sponsoring a big famous screen star and big industrialist, the guy that put the American flag on the moon I've worked with. And they come down there in their MGs and Mercedes and park in front of the mission I work in, come in and talk to me because I'm their sponsor. And I talk to them about how to live more comfortably. Now, nowhere else in the world do you find someone making $500,000 a year drive down to a Skid Row mission to find out how to make it. I feel like that happens all over the world. There's incongruity all over the world. Apparently, but it isn't incongruous because we all know it, what it is. Now, what do we wind up here? We wind up with people who are intelligent, bright, some of us, all types of people, but one thing we don't have. We really don't have a clue on how to live when things get tough, when the emotions come back. They say, go to AA, work the steps, maybe the answer, but those steps, not much of an answer when you're feeling desperate. And that is why, for some people, myself and many others like me, having a sponsor was the most important single relationship I'd had in my life up till then. The function of a sponsor. Of course, there's a joke function of a sponsor that's really, there's a grain of truth in it. The function of a sponsor, is one thought, is to keep the alcoholic entertained long enough for the program to work. And there's a lot of truth in that. But for some of us who are goofy, I have no tools to live. I mean, I can write, I have all sorts of things, all the things I've done. But when it's 2 o'clock in the morning and the ogres are coming at me, last year's success doesn't mean much. And the function of a sponsor is to, in the last analysis, superimpose actions that I will take that my mind rejects. I don't know of a better answer what a sponsor does. They say action is the magic word, but my judgments would be very, very critical of the actions AA offers. There's really, the actions they have here, to anyone with a grain of sense, are goofy. You know, I am feeling sad, I'm feeling desperate, All the past is coming back on me. I've been sober 6 months. I've just lost my job as a dishwasher. This is a true story at the moment. Thinking about what might have been and if only, and I call my sponsor, I say, Bob, I've lost my job as a dishwasher. What am I going to do? Now, he's supposed to say, we love you, son.
Why don't you write your goddamn inventory the way I told you?
And I didn't say anything, but I thought, why don't you? I forget what it was. It was fun to watch him try it. But I tried to explain it. Bob, in my judgment, that's the last thing in the world, and I'm just haunted by memories, and I'm living in an abandoned car, and I'm broke, and I'm sick, Bob, and writing an inventory, in my judgment, that'll kill me.
He says, in your judgment? Who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car.
If I wanted your judgment, I'd put my head in the back window and ask you for it.
I'm living in a $350,000 house in Pacific Palisades.
Now, that is not what you and I would think would be a good gesture of love with him. He got me so upset that day, I took an inventory. I'm glad I felt good that night, because I, as far as I could tell, it didn't help. That cheered me up right there. A week later, I was never going to read this, because I was so upset that day. I wrote things in that inventory in which I wasn't the hero. One of the things he said,
write down things you wouldn't tell your psychiatrist.
I said, are you crazy? I told my psychiatrist everything. Then as after I wrote that, I thought, half of this stuff I never told my psychiatrist. Because I don't know about you, but like me, I'm kind of insecure. When I'm paying big money for a psychiatrist, I'm not going to tell that guy things that are going to make him dislike me. Tell him things and have him say, get out of my office, you sick bastard. Yeah. I just tell him things that enable him to help me. I wrote things in there that were dreadful. And a week later, I was feeling terrible again. He said, how are you feeling? Terrible. He says, come on, get your stinking inventory. Get in the car. And he drove 40 miles along the ocean to Oxnard after a meeting. He had a flashlight, and I read this to him. Oh. And I thought, he's going to throw me out of his car. We got near Oxnard, and I'd just gone through some terribly turgid thing. Oh. And I looked over, and he's going, I've made the old fool snap. I since then have taken that trip maybe 200 and some times. That same trip, only on the driver's side, while some other little puke reads. And they always start off the same. Now, before I read this, let me explain some of these things. Just read it, dummy. And when we get up near Oxnard, I'm a much better sponsor than my sponsor was. I always turn my head when I yawn. There's only so many things you can do with your mind and body, but you don't know it, you know. In fact, when a guy gets into his inventory after a while, you can, within 10 minutes, you can almost hear where it's going. You know, you can just know where it's going to wind up, that pattern. You can tell when things are left out, you say. Didn't you leave something out there? Have you been talking to that bitch? No. No. It's an interesting concept. Some of you may have heard me say this before, but I don't know a better way to put it. A sponsor must make their pigeon, at least if they're dealing with immature emotions, find actions. As we said last night, the difference between most philosophies and AA. Philosophies say, we'll change your thinking and your actions will change. Here we realize we have to take actions, and as a result of that, our thinking changes. But it takes a long time, and sometimes you have flashbacks where after you're sober a while, you have a day as though you never had a day of sobriety. Just boom, and you got to get through that. But the best way I know to describe it, as I've used to try to describe it before, like this curtain here. Now, when you're new and feeling bad, your sponsor is giving you perceptions that you do not have, and they look stupid. And I felt it would be as though someone came up to me, my sponsor came up to me and said, see that curtain, kid? That curtain is green. No, it isn't. That's a dark red. I tell you, it's green. You know, is he shucking me? Is it some kind of a game? Is he goofy? Is he finally snapped as I thought he would? Bob, that is green. Well, I don't care how it looks to you. You act like it's green. And now, we never talked about the colorations of curtains. He never said the curtain was green. But he gave me other perceptions equally as stupid. Such as, go over and apologize to that woman for calling her a bitch. She is a bitch. Why do you think she's a bitch? Because she told her newcomers not to go out with me. She was right. Go over and apologize. Bitch. I don't care how it looks to you. Don't quit that job.
But they're screwing me, Bob. They're paying the next desk. She's doing less than I'm. She's getting paid more money. They're using me just because I'm an alcoholic somehow.
You're goofy is what you are. Don't quit the job. If you want to quit that job, have another job to go to. Don't ever quit a job without having a job to go to. You hear that? Don't leave that meeting.
I'm not going back to that meeting. It's all just a click. They never call on me. They're just a bunch of little friends, and they do things. Treat me like I'm different.
Well, you are different. We're going to get you over that. And on and on. And took these actions, and stupid actions, and wrote an inventory. Wrote letters of amend to people I'd just like to kill. Just terrible things. And over a period of time, much to my surprise, the curtain turned green. And now I must spend the rest of my life cursed working with dumb idiot newcomers who think that stinking curtain is red. It wasn't that way in the old days, I'll tell you. We were sincere. I think that's one of the great reasons for sponsorship. Some people don't require that intense sponsorship. Some people have had some normal living, crossed over a line. That's what they mean in the book, return to normal living. But a lot of people never had any normal living to return to. They wouldn't know normal living if it bit them in the leg. I wouldn't. And so we find, I think, what we need to do to take these actions. As I said last night, I want to reiterate it one more time, because I believe that that is the most accurate description I know. Action certainly is the magic word, but you can't get people to take it. The purpose and function of Alcoholics Anonymous in its last analysis is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help them identify enough
so that they will begin to take actions they do not yet believe in. And that's what it's all about. And love of God won't keep you sober apparently very long. And psychiatric insights won't keep you sober. That's why the book says specifically, action is the magic word. And has another line in there that really is so easily overlooked. People whine and moan and cry, and I've done more than my share. And the line says, when all else fails, work with another alcoholic. You can't always be a sponsor, but by God, you can simulate interest in somebody and get that sick mind off yourself. Because that's the number one goal of sponsorship, I believe, as the sponsor. When I'm thinking about his crap, I'm not thinking about my crap. And we are a group of people who have maintained self-obsession. Great characteristics of alcoholics, self-obsession. I remember once upon a time a guy said, Clancy, you're too egocentric. By that time I was become a little humble. I said, no, I'm not. I hardly think highly of myself at all. He said, I don't mean that. I don't mean that you think highly of yourself. You think constantly of yourself. Yes, I understand that. Self-obsession is the great enemy of all of us. Nearly all of the actions in AA are designed to get me out of self. They're designed to make me do nice things for other people. They're never designed for other people. They're designed for my sobriety. Making amends may be nice,